Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For years, the Bush administration promised hundreds of millions of dollars for clean coal, a plan to capture carbon emissions from coal-fired power plants and pump them deep into the earth. Carbon sequestration, as it's known, was called the best hope for keeping energy cheap and the environment green. But the Department of Energy just pulled the plug on the experimental plant at the heart of the FutureGen project. The science, politics, and implications of that are fascinating and more than a little scary. This hour, On Point, a setback for clean coal and where the environment and economy go now. Joining me first today is Keith Johnson. He covers energy and the environment for the Wall Street Journal. He's also the lead writer for the paper's Environmental Capital blog. Joins us today, happens to join us from Spain, Madrid. Keith, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm good. What was this project, and what has happened to it, and why?
Well, you know, basically, FutureGen was sort of a moonshot for the federal government to take an experimental plant, not even commercial size, and sort of work out all the kinks in the technology that would be needed to get clean coal onto a realistic footing. What seems to have happened is that cost overruns and things like that have sort of dampened the appetite for the federal government to keep pouring money into FutureGen. So right now it's sort of back to the drawing board. The DOE's plan right now is to distribute funds to a number of different commercial plants and see if maybe with a little bit of financial footing, they can help them develop some clean coal technologies.
Now, Keith, take us back to a couple of basics here. When American coal-fired plants or any other burn coal to generate electricity, presumably there's all kinds of particulate matter, but there's also the gas, CO2, carbon dioxide, and that is a particular concern because it's a major greenhouse gas. Have I got that right?
No, absolutely. It's a major greenhouse gas, and of course, in the U.S. electricity mix, it's a major contributor. Just under 49% of U.S. power is generated from coal-fired plants. So quite clearly, if you're going to tackle greenhouse gas emissions and carbon dioxide emissions, you have to start with coal. It's also the U.S.'s most abundant energy resource. So the idea was, if we can figure out a way to make clean coal plants work, then we've got relatively clean, secure energy for the foreseeable future.
And the sort of forward anticipated course of coal use in the United States, more, or something else?
Well, the problem is that there's no real way to substitute half of a nation's energy supply overnight. There's coal reserves to last for a few centuries. If there weren't concerns about climate change and global warming and CO2 emissions, that wouldn't even be an issue. The problem is now we need to find a way to start cutting back on the CO2 emissions while still taking advantage of all of the resources that the country has.
Now, presumably, many other nations are going to be burning more and more coal as well as their own energy demands grow. China's already got a big problem. If we can't figure out how to pump carbon emissions back into the earth, what are the implications for the environment?
Well, for the environment, obviously, over the next century, if China, India, the rest of Europe, which still has a pretty heavy coal component, if regular old-fashioned vanilla coal-fired plants continue to come online, then carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere are only going to grow. That much is clear. But at the same time, coal makes such a tremendous contribution to the world's energy mix. You can't just wave a magic wand and come up with a solution for it. Basically, what's going to have to happen is a cocktail of different things. Further advances on clean coal technology to try to take some of this carbon dioxide out of the coal plants themselves and store it underground. And at the same time, a lot of policy advocates talk about a mix of more nuclear power, more renewable energies, things like that.
Now, this so-called FutureGen Alliance, a consortium of coal companies and electric utilities, was pulled together to push forward on this carbon sequestration project. They had a site picked out in Mattoon, Illinois, where they were going to do what, Keith?
Well, there was going to be the site for a relatively small experimental plant that was going to use some pretty new technology, which kind of gasifies the coal and enables them to trap the carbon dioxide initially, you know, before it's burned, and then they use the gas to actually fire turbines. So it's a much cleaner process than a regular coal plant would be. One of the advantages of Mattoon over some of the other sites that the Department of Energy had looked at was that right nearby they had places to store the CO2 underground. So it's a pretty suitable location to be able to set up a plant that could cleanly burn the coal, and then they could put it underground and start to monitor it and make sure that the stuff was stored safely.
Now, the Department of Energy said that it was getting too expensive, getting up toward $1.8 billion estimate for the plan, that commercial interest ought to be able to carry it at this point, and so they're pulling out entirely of that experimental plant. But I mean, I guess there is no other doing that at the moment. Your blog at the Wall Street Journal says the fight over the fate of FutureGen, Uncle Sam's controversial clean coal experiment, keeps getting nastier. What's the nastiness here?
Well, it's a little bit of a he said, she said, and back and forth. But basically, you know, industry had signed on to this with the understanding that the government would pick up some of the tab for the kind of the experimental heavy lifting. And what's happened is that the government's part of the bill has gone up by about 38% or so. It's gone up from, I don't know, about $800 million to about $1.1 billion. Small fry within a $3.1 trillion budget, but still. It's gone up a little bit more than they had expected. And so their plan now is to channel some funds from the federal government to existing plants and see if they can sort of tweak carbon dioxide storage in different ways, rather than doing one sort of elaborate experimental plant.
So are the commercial interests here, the coal companies and electric utilities, just trying to get out of bearing that extra cost? Or are they afraid that without the sort of moonshot federal government backing, we won't find a way to sequester the CO2 and we'll have dirty plants and all the problems that come with that?
Well, I mean, this is the reason the government got behind this in the first place. It's not commercial technology right now. It won't be for many years. And you need the federal government to put its heft, both policy-wise and budget-wise, behind finding a solution for this. A lot of countries are working on this. Germany and Britain, China's actually starting to work on clean coal now. But this isn't an overnight solution. And the understanding that the FutureGen Alliance had was that the U.S. government would pick up the tab for some of the more onerous parts of the program. And now the Department of Energy is saying, you know what, it doesn't seem to make so much sense as we thought a few years ago.
Wow. So maybe it'll happen in the USA, and maybe it won't. Maybe it'll happen anywhere. Maybe it won't, but we sure hope that it does. Keith Johnson with the Wall Street Journal joining us today from Madrid. Keith, thanks very much for your work on this, and thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I want to welcome into the conversation right now Howard Herzog. He is a principal research engineer at MIT's Laboratory for Energy and the Environment, program manager of the Carbon Sequestration Initiative. It's also an industry consortium. He's been a technical advisor on carbon sequestration to FutureGen, the outfit that just got its funding pulled in large part last week. Howard Herzog, thanks very much for being here.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
How important is it for us to figure out a way to take these CO2 gases and pump them back underground?
I think it's critical that we understand what this technology can contribute to carbon mitigation. I mean, if you don't have this, you have two choices. One, you have, as the previous speaker said, just increased CO2 emissions from coal plants all over the world, driving our greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere to levels that the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, just says are too dangerous for us to live with.
People are already talking about significant global warming potentially in this century. If we don't get a handle on CO2 emissions from coal, which is exploding in use, what are the implications for climate change?
Well, as I say, what one has to do if you don't get those under control, I think the impacts of climate change will just be things I think we don't want to see. total changes in drought and rainfall, floods, changes in agricultural patterns, rising sea levels, and the like. You know, a lot of the Europeans want us to stabilize at 450 parts per million, which I think is impossible to do today.
We've already overshot, you think?
We're at 380 now, but I think it's, you just can't turn this battleship around to get a 450. I think even 550 is tricky. A lot of people think 450, we're playing with fire. 550, we're really in trouble. But if we don't start doing this, we could be at 750 by the end of the century, and no one knows what that means.
Al Gore's nightmare. You're the scientist, and we're going to look at the science of how this might be done. But Keith Johnson referred to it as a moonshot. Makes it sound like a kind of Manhattan Project. Is it doable? Is it within our scientific grasp to sequester, to sort of bury all this CO2 emissions? Or is it still, you know, like fantastically difficult looking?
It's difficult because of the scale. The technologies to do each of the components you would need to do, which is to capture the CO2 at the power plant, to transport it to a site, to inject it underground, and to monitor it underground, all of those technologies exist in one form or the other today. They don't exist as integrated systems, which is one thing Future Gen was supposed to address, and they don't exist at the scale we're going to need. The scale we're going to need is similar to the scale we have for exploration and production of, say, oil and gas resources.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a big setback to dreams of clean coal and its implications for the environment and the economy. The Bush administration has pulled the plug on Future Gen, the country's flagship effort to sequester carbon emissions and rein in coal's rough impact on the global climate. Howard Herzog is with us, principal research engineer at MIT's Laboratory for Energy and the Environment, program manager on the Carbon Sequestration Initiative, and he has been a technical advisor on carbon sequestration to Future Gen. In a moment, we'll hear from Jeff Goodell, author of Big Coal, but let's go right to our listeners. Greg's calling from McGregor, Iowa. Hi, Greg. You're on the air.
Yeah, Tom. Thanks for letting me participate in this discussion.
Certainly.
I'm a farmer, and I'm feeding cattle as we speak. My comment is that we really had the perfect system for sequestering carbon, which was native prairie, and it could do what we want it to do if we would quit plowing this ground and planting corn for ethanol and let this prairie grass grow and produce healthy food for healthy consumers.
So you're saying, Greg, plow under all the corn and soybeans and let the prairie grow back up over I don't know how many eons, and that might do the trick you're hoping. Why not pump it underground?
Oh, we're just chasing an energy dream there. The prairies intensively grazed with man's management, way better system, foolproof, fail-proof.
Greg, let me put that to our scientist sitting right here and see what he's got to say. But before I do, let me get one more call from Shawnee, Oklahoma. Russell, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
The question I have, we're talking about putting all this CO2 underground and everything. What else are we goes with the CO2 underground? How is it contained? And my big concern is our underground aquifers. And I'm getting polluted. And I'll take my answer off here.
Pump it all underground, and what do you get? The earth with gas. Howard Herzog, I think for a lot of lay people, for me, it's hard to really picture this. I mean, we know the volume of coal-fired energy in this country. The emissions must be just gigantic. Begin to explain to us how one would even go about pumping this all underground. Where does it go? And then don't forget our cattle farmer Greg's thought that, just turn the Midwest back into prairie and somehow want to absorb those carbon emissions.
Well, when people say sequestration, there's sometimes two things. One time is what we can call these biological sequestrations or enhancing natural sinks, and that's what our friend from Iowa was talking about. And
prairie grass would have sucked this up out of the atmosphere in a way that corn and beans don't?
Well, it's a matter of what I would say your stocks. You have to let the stocks of carbon grow up in your soils and in your vegetation, such as forest or certain grasses.
To address this scale of emission, yeah. Would we have to like put all the U.S.
Well,
back in
that's
forest?
That's the problem. There's not enough land to do that. So in some of the international agreements, there's plans to do this. It will help in a small way, but it doesn't have the scale to do the massive amount of emissions that we need to have this uptake through natural sources.
So at scale, you're suggesting you've got to pump it underground. What does it take to do that, and what are the implications of doing it? Our caller in Shawnee, Oklahoma.
Well, the first thing you'd have to do is capture and basically liquefy the CO2, so you have it in a much reduced volume.
Where does that happen? I mean, you're not taking the smokestack on a coal-fired plant and just kind of bending it over like Popeye or Superman and plugging
it
underground.
You're putting the gas that comes up the smokestack through a chemical process, and that chemical process will pull the CO2 out of that gas, and then you compress it to make it a liquid.
So you take it out of gaseous form, it becomes a liquid,
You take it out of the gaseous form into a solvent. So you sort of bubble the gas.
That would run like water?
Think of the gas,
is it fluid in that sense?
Think of the gas going through, interacting with some fluid, and that fluid, which is CO2 is an acid, and
yes.
This fluid is a base,
mm-hmm.
and that base will pull the CO2 out, a simple acid-base reaction, just like vinegar baking soda we did when we were kids.
But by the time you get it headed underground, it's actually a liquid, a fluid.
It's actually a liquid.
Okay. And where are you pumping it into? What about the aquifers?
You're pumping it deep. First of all, you're pumping it deep, so you're away from the freshwater aquifers that we want to protect. And in fact, to pump it underground, there's something in the U.S. called the Safe Water Drinking Act, an underground injection control program run by the EPA, and you need to get a permit from them. And to get that permit, you have to prove that you're not going to harm these water aquifers
about. When it comes to our very drinking water, we might still be a little leery about that approval and how much to count on it. How deep do you have to go to get beneath freshwater aquifers?
Well, you want to get to about 800 meters deep, which is about 2,500 feet deep, so the CO2 stays in the liquid form. You need to keep it under pressure to keep the CO2 liquid, and you need to go to that depth to keep the pressures that you want.
And what are you pumping it into at that depth? Do you have to find cavities in the earth to pump it into, or can you pump it straight into porous rock?
You don't really have cavities in the earth. It's porous rock. A lot of these cavities are the same type of cavities that our oil and gas have been kept in, and some of these gas reservoirs have been kept there for millions of years, and that's why we think you take the gas out, you put the CO2 back in. Now,
over time, does it bubble up and turn all our aquifers into carbonated beverages?
Over time, the indications are that the mechanisms in the earth, the longer it stays in the earth, the less likely it is to come out. Because when you first put it in, it stays all together as a CO2 phase, but eventually it starts reacting with other things down there. It gets incorporated into the soil matrix. It starts reacting with the water. There's brines in these aquifers, very salt water in there. It starts reacting with that and getting absorbed in there, which immobilizes it. And eventually it could even react with the rock and precipitate out. So over time, it becomes immobilized and less likely to come out.
So there's the science, and it's fascinating. I want to look at the economics of this as well. Let me turn to Jeff Goodell. He joins us from Los Angeles, a journalist and author. He's followed the coal mining industry very closely. He's author of Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future. Jeff Goodell, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
We'll look some more at what's happening with future gen, but just the idea of sequestering all this carbon, all this CO2, first of all, can you imagine it being done for all the carbon emissions of coal-fired plants in just, let's take the United States, Jeff? And if we did that, at whatever huge cost would come with that, would coal be a cheap source of energy anymore?
Well, I mean, first of all, you hit on the important point here, which is the scale of this. I mean, the amount of carbon dioxide that we would have to pump underground, this would be an enormous engineering project. I mean, something like pumping half of the CO2 that comes out of coal plants today would require an infrastructure similar to the entire oil and gas infrastructure we have in the United States. So this is a huge engineering
project. So you're talking
project.
Pipelines and pipe and pumps and I mean something giant. Is it doable? Could you do it? Could we sequester all our carbon emissions?
Well, I think it'd be very difficult to sequester all of it. I mean, physically, we have enough space underground. But I think, as you pointed out earlier, the question is economics. And one of the problems, you know, with this, the way this whole energy policy is working about this is it's a lot of it is about perpetuating coal. And the question is, are there better ways to do it? I mean, it may be that coal does not make the transition to a world that takes global warming seriously. We're seeing all kinds of other very creative ideas that might displace coal, like large-scale solar thermal installations, engineered geothermal, where you actually drill down and use the Earth's heat.
So when the Department of Energy pulls the plug on this project, Jeff, do you see them as progressive, looking beyond coal to cleaner sources of energy, or regressive, saying, you know, good luck, we're off with coal and we're not going to help make it clean?
No, I think that what we're seeing here is just bowing to the reality that this is expensive. And, you know, I think that this does not mean the end of federal efforts for clean coal. I think they're going to put a lot of money into other sort of just smaller projects, which may actually be a smarter way to go. And I think it would be great if we could make this carbon capture and storage work. But I think that anyone who thinks that we're going to be able to do this simply and cheaply, and that we're going to simply be able to carry on with burning coal and burying it underground and go on our merry way, is kidding themselves. I mean, this may work on a limited scale in the future, but we're really going to have to transition away from coal.
Let's take a call from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Bagirad. Hi, Bagirad. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. How are you doing?
Well.
Pumping the CO2 in the ground is a self-defeating proposition, because with every carbon that we burn, we are taking away two oxygen atoms. And it took billions of years to get the enough oxygen level using the, you know, the plants and algae and other things, you know, created the oxygen for us to survive on the earth. Now, if you start pumping all these oxygen back into the ground along with the carbon, what will happen? We are still going to lose. So there should be some another alternative, not this. I'll take the answer of the air.
All right. Howard Herzog, Bagirad, say this is self-defeating. You know, the basic science doesn't work. He's kind of back to the maybe plant more trees suggestion, but if there's not room for that, what about the basics here? I mean, does it work long-term to just keep pumping this stuff, pumping it underground?
Well, when you've got to look at this in context, and I think most of us that work on this concept, first thing we say, this is not a silver bullet. Mm-hmm. It's one of many bullets in your arsenal you're going to need to make up the thing. But there are no silver bullets anywhere.
So what's your sense? It might just save us for one century while we're still burning coal until we get to something better? Or?
I mean, one way to look at it, it could be a bridging strategy to develop the energy source for the 22nd century, mm-hmm. Whatever that would be. But the reality is now, as our first speaker said, that there's really no good alternative for coal today. You know, we're not. It doesn't look like we're prepared to go massively nuclear, and even if we were, the cost for that could be just as much as.
And you've got a waste to bury there too.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Solar and wind are fine, but can they be done at the scale? I mean, how could you even imagine wind being done at the scale if we can't even build a few windmills off of
Cape
Nantucket?
Cod. Yeah. So if it's just a bridging strategy, now the federal government's kind of pulling out here. Yeah. Is this sequestration breakthrough going to come without federal support? You've been down there in the trenches working. Will it happen without that?
The answer is no. And also, Jeff mentioned geothermal energy. That won't happen without a lot of federal funding either.
But do you see this as a betrayal then by the federal government? You've been working on this thing. They're not going to support it. Jeff says maybe small outfits will do it. They say maybe commercial should pick up and take over. What's the logic of stepping away from this? If we're using coal every day in huge volume and it's not going to happen without their support, $1.8 billion is expensive, but it's nothing compared to what we're...
That's right. If you're talking a problem that's trillions of dollars, what's $300 million more to the government? It just makes no sense to me.
So do you see the Bush administration having surrendered its principle here of trying to find a way to clean coal, or sincerely believing that commercial interest will do it better?
I think they're fooling themselves if they think this new plan's going to be any better than the first or any cheaper than the first in terms of bang for the buck. I also look, if you look at some of the
this
press
new
releases.
New plant referring to something beyond Mattoon, you mean? Or?
Well, they say they're restructuring FutureGen and they're going to replace it with some smaller projects.
Yeah.
But carbon capture and storage has to be integrated in with the power plant. You can't put the power plant over here, carbon capture and storage over here, and you think it's going to be simple. The integration is critical and key. The other thing is, if you look in the press releases, They said, well, the new one, we're not going to worry about hydrogen. But why was hydrogen in Future Gen in the first place? It was there at the insistence of the federal government, and now they're turning their backs on it. It makes no sense to me at all.
Let me take a call from Paul in Easton, Massachusetts. Hi, Paul. You're on the air with Howard Herzog and Jeff Goodell.
Thanks, Tom, for another important show. I think that the original plan for Future Gen was about half right, but I think we need a new idea, and I'm going to build up for a second.
Okay.
But one thing, keep in mind that the Internet these days allows scientists and engineers from all over the world, from China, Germany, the U.S., and so on, to put their heads together, bounce ideas off each other.
That's great. That happens all over. How does that help
right.
us here?
Okay. Now, the thing is that we need to sequester carbon from smokestacks and from the upper atmosphere, where it's causing the global warming problem.
You're going to put a vacuum tube up there and suck it down somehow?
Up there we could have planes, and they could freeze it or liquefy it, you know, dry ice, you've seen that, and they could bring it down here for reprocessing.
Are they going to fly up there with jet fuel? I mean, do we really end up with a net gain?
The planes should use solar power when they're up there. But anyway, the thing is that what we need to do with the CO2 once we have it is to recycle it. All of our food and most of our fuels are carbon-based.
So you're going to turn it into Cheetos or something?
And plants take CO2 and water, and they turn it into sugars and starches everything else. And plants by themselves would be nice if they could do the job of all this volume, but I agree with Dr. Herzog that they couldn't take the volume. So we need to come up with an industrial process that sort of imitates photosynthesis, but in our way, using something called catalysis, which lowers the hurdles of things, you know, to happen, and maybe lasers to supply just the right energy and so on. And I think that if the scientists put their heads together from all over the world, not just our government, but all the governments kind of cooperate on this, then there'd be enough money and enough brain power so we could make faster than usual progress toward a focused goal.
Paul, it sounds like you've given this a lot more thought than I have, and this stuff sounds wild, but I don't know. Maybe it's a great idea. Howard Herzog, is there something we can do with this other than pump it underground? Can you, zap it with lasers and catalysis and turn it into Cheetos?
Lots of people.
Not that we need more Cheetos.
Right. Lots of people have looked at it, and here's the problem. Carbon dioxide is spent fuel. When you burn a hydrocarbon, you get carbon dioxide and water. So there's carbon there, but there's no energy there. Mm-hmm. To recycle it back into the economy in one way or the other, you need energy. Now, he's right. Plants do that, but they use energy.
Solar.
They use solar energy to do that. So it's not just a carbon problem, but it's an energy problem. And usually what happens when you try to convert that CO2 back into it, you use more energy, you know, you lose energy in every processing step. And you start chasing your tail. And so where's that other energy come from? If it's carbon-free, why don't we use that carbon-free energy in the first place instead of using carbon-based energy?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a big setback to dreams of clean coal. The Bush administration last week pulled the plug on most of Future Gen, the country's flagship effort to sequester carbon emissions and rein in coal's very rough impact on the global climate. I'm just fascinated by the scale of the technology here, the scale of this challenge, all the interests at play under the covers here. Been joined by Howard Herzog of MIT. He's been a technical advisor on carbon sequestration for Future Gen. And Jeff Goodell joining us from Los Angeles, journalist, author, follows the coal industry closely, author of Big Coal. Jeff, what about the coal industry itself? You said maybe a bunch of commercial efforts will help this. Is the coal industry itself focused on this? If the feds step back a little bit, are they going to step up and make themselves clean?
No, that's an easy answer to that. I mean, I think that the coal industry's strategy on this for a long time has been, you know, to delay any kind of federal action, and they've been one of the, you know, they have a tremendous lobbying power, and they've been have a tremendous influence on keeping us from, on a federal policy level, taking this seriously. I mean, I think when we think about this, the policy failure of future generations, I think we have to think about it more broadly. I mean, you know, we don't, if we had a significant price on carbon dioxide emissions, if we could let the market begin to function and to acknowledge, you know, if we had a $30 a ton or something price on carbon emissions, that would change the dynamics in a big way. And you know, we could begin to see some of these projects sorting themselves out. We could begin to see investments flowing towards low-carbon technology.
But we don't have that, and now we don't have really future gen either. Do you see this project as having been somehow politically spiked by the coal industry or not?
I don't know what happened backstage. I think that future gen has been a very important political device for the coal industry to allow them to continue building conventional coal plants.
And because they, what did they say? Well, sooner or later, these will be cleaned up with carbon sequestration?
Right. You look at these coal ads that are running during all of the debates and on primary nights and things, and they all show future gen in them. It's been this sort of bright, shiny object that they've been dangling in front of us for a long time.
The green patina thrown over everything.
Well, saying, you know, we're building these old coal plants now, but, you know, we're going to have future gen pretty soon, and then we'll fix everything, and coal will be clean, and it'll be, you know, a wonderful fuel for the 21st century. And now we're seeing just how complex that really is. And so there's been a lot of political shenanigans backstage on this, and it's been very useful to the coal industry to have this future gen thing out there.
What a picture. I mean, it's just, it's kind of mind-blowing when you think about the implications and the scale, and now this is off the table. Let's take a call from Nashville, Tennessee. Tom, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you for accepting my call.
Yeah.
Go back about 60 years ago, and I'm sure most of you don't remember, but back then, every house, every factory, whether it be a steel mill, tire, whatever, all was fueled by coal. That it was so bad that if it snowed, the very next morning, the ground, the snow would be covered with black soot.
So what, were those the good old days? Or what are you saying, Tom?
What I'm saying is that nature took care of it. And I think what we need to do is lean back on nature a little bit, because we don't burn anywhere near the coal today that we did back then, because we didn't have gas furnaces in the houses. Every house, every manufacturer, they all burn coal.
Tom, let us pick it up. So you're saying just pump it up there right into the sky and let nature take care of it, Howard Herzog? How about it?
Well, we use a heck of a lot more coal today than we did back then. The problem was when you're burning it in a house with no emissions controls on it, it gets very dirty. When they're burning in these power plants, they have very good emissions controls.
So that's for the particulate matter. They're scrubbing what percentage of that out these days?
Oh, well over almost all of it.
Mm-hmm.
They're scrubbing out the sulfur dioxides. They're scrubbing out the nitric oxides. So all of that's being taken care of to fairly strict levels that are continuing to be ratcheted down.
But it's the greenhouse gases that we're not on top of, carbon.
It's carbon dioxide. It's only in the back then, people didn't realize that would be a problem. But now we do, and that is not under control, and that's what the real issue is today.
Nature just can't swallow this one. Let's get Eben from Vergennes, Vermont. Hi, Eben. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I am so struck every time I hear conversations by this when we talk about the scale of what we are trying to tackle as far as our energy demands.
Yes.
That it seems so backwards to me, because no one is tackling what is out of scale is our energy consumption, and we continuously turn down what would be considered viable alternative clean energies because, well, it can't keep up with what we are consuming. It seems that we've so put the horse in front of, or the cart in front of the horse in this. If we would put like a 9/11 responsive effort into real energy conservation in America, I think all these solutions would be so much more viable.
Well, first of all, I'm not sure what you mean by a 9/11 scale response. I'm not sure what the 9/11 response was, but
the effort that we put into that,
Well, what do? We put some more guys in the airport, but that's another subject. And I admire and sympathize exactly with what you're saying. And you know, God bless Vermont for kind of carrying the torch on this. But when you look realistically at this country, Eben, do you really think that it's going to take its foot off the gas of energy consumption quickly enough if we don't figure out some way to deal with the downstream pollution that that consumption produces?
Well, unfortunately, that's actually a big weight on me is that I think as humanity, I think we are not. I think individuals, we are just not willing to take our foot off the gas. And I don't know what the solution is, but I see every day people being concerned about it, but they are simply not changing their lifestyles to take this problem seriously.
Well, we'll take this as one more demonstration of how important that is and could be if we'd actually do it. On the other hand, there's a race going on, and maybe we've got to address both sides. But, Evan, thank you for that. Let's go to Dave in Westport, Massachusetts. Dave, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I'm a local activist opposing conversion of a local electric generating facility to coal gasification. And I really believe that this entire sequestration is a put-up job by the coal industry to peddle us another generation of dirty power. And to illustrate that, they have absolutely no way to sequester carbon dioxide in New England. There are no geologic features in which you could pump this carbon dioxide if, in fact, they are able to do it in a few years or 20 years. And the proof of that, to me, is that they were going to convert to this gasification, let all the carbon dioxide go up the flue, and they were, in their publications, they were calling it sequestration ready.
Right, you could be ready for a long time. Hold the pose.
I'm kidding. And in the meantime, another trazillion tons of carbon dioxide pumped directly into the atmosphere. I think it's a phony. I think it's a public relations ploy.
Well, Dave, you raise a couple of interesting points there, and good luck with your work. But Howard Herzog, first to you on the geologic structures front. Now, I know New England pretty well at this point, and I know Mattoon, Illinois pretty well. I used to go to a swimming hole there. Is there some difference in geologic substructure that makes some regions of the country, I don't know, with rolling, not so rolling, cornfields and beans better than craggy New England for trapping this stuff?
Absolutely. Just like there's a difference in some parts of the country, you have oil and gas production, others don't. Some have coal production, others don't. Same here. The
so if New England did sequester it, would they have to build pipelines to take that somewhere, I don't know,
there's
put it
not,
underneath Illinois,
we don't know. We don't know a lot about the underground here in New England because we haven't poked a lot of holes in it where they have in, say, places that they've tried to discover other resources.
Oil, gas. Mm-hmm.
Oil and gas, coal. Mm-hmm. So we don't know. There's some hope that maybe offshore in the sedimentary basins there may be some things. Maybe if you can pipe it up to Nova Scotia, it seems like there's some things there. But New England isn't, say, rich in geologic resources. It doesn't mean that it absolutely can't happen, but it's more difficult here than other parts
of the
country.
But then economically, are we kidding ourselves again to our caller from Vermont's point? If you've got to be piping it all over the country to get rid of it, is it ever really going to be a solution?
Here's what I say. If you're going to try to cut CO2 emissions between 50 and 80% by 2050, which is sort of what we've signed on to. We didn't put those numbers there, but that's what the world wants us to sign on to.
Is that Kyoto or Al Gore or George W. or who's asking for
this
that?
This is our president signed on at the meeting in Bali to go through a two-year process to negotiate some things. This is the target the world wants to look at.
Right.
And if we want to get there, it's going to cost money one way or another. You're not going to be able to provide carbon, that type of energy that people want to do to get there without investments. We are not making the investments, and energy price will go up. That's the type of world you got to look at this in, not the type of world that we have today of very cheap energy.
Wow, this is urgent and fascinating. And, Jeff, I want to get you on this, but let me get another coal industry observer first here, Jonathan in Beaufort, South Carolina. Jonathan, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak. Just from my perspective, growing up in West Virginia, in the heart of a coal mining area, part of this discussion is practice versus principle. And the track record and things that I saw growing up, of course, the influx of interest and use of coal would help out West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure they're looking forward to what might be on the horizon, but fact of the matter is, what it's going to require to do this, I don't foresee these companies taking it to heart. Like I said, practice versus principle. You grow up and you see the mine waste and slag and the dump sites and strip jobs.
Yep, I've seen them.
We're not talking about an industry who's very watchful, and when profit is injected into it, principle goes out the window.
So would you like to see the federal government get back into this and actually follow it through, Jonathan, or some other party? I don't know who.
No, it's very obvious that there are so many more things we can be doing with the money and resources going towards promoting something that I don't see as realistic, and it's certainly not a long-term answer. To reference an old sales book called Who Moved the Cheese, we just got to find other answers, and I hate to see the money, time, and everything put towards a solution that sounds good on the surface, but when it comes down to getting your boots in the mud, I've never seen anything from the history of the mining operations growing up that would suggest that they would take such a costly and in-depth approach to refining the process.
Jonathan, you sound like the voice of wise experience there, and we thank you for that. Look for alternatives, conserve our alternatives. Let's get one more from Charlottesville, Virginia. Al, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to know if your panel would comment on the concept of what's happening in the federal government these days. The Bush administration has just sent a monster deficit budget to the Hill.
$3 trillion.
Yeah, and I can see them sitting around as they're preparing this budget and saying, well, what can we cut? Well, we never really buy the science on the CO2 and warming anyway, and this thing is so far down the road, let's just cut it out. I would suspect that, agreeing with Dr. Herzog, that this is such a vital component of our energy future that a new administration may put those funds back in.
So maybe it comes back. We don't know. Jeff Goodell, first on the coal industry, boots in the mud. You've been there with this industry. Should we just be somehow desperately trying to bag coal rather than figure out sequestration, or do we have a choice in your view?
Well, I mean, I think that that caller pointed out a really good point, which is that, you know, the coal industry does have a real history of regulatory abuse. And I think it's important to say that this is not a, you know, phony technology. I mean, this can work. There's a lot of very serious scientists who are looking at this.
And I'm sitting with one right here.
Right. And so there's nothing phony about this. But the problem is that this is a huge regulatory issue. We've talked about the technological parts of this, but it's also a huge regulatory issue. Who is going to check to make sure this stuff actually stays underground? How are we going to monitor this? For the coal industry, this is about disposing of a waste. I mean, they want to do it as cheaply and as quickly as possible. And I think that as that caller pointed out, we're right to be suspicious about how this is going to be monitored.
I mean, even if we achieved the technology, you think they'd sort of, I don't know, put in a fake system and continue to bleed CO2 into the atmosphere? Or?
No, not a fake system, but as Howard pointed out, I mean, the geological structure varies in different parts of the country, different parts of the world. Some places are very well suited to it. Some places aren't. Some places have much more potential for leakage. Some places are much more secure, and it's often sold as a solution for China also. Well, in China, they're building coal plants without even any permits. I mean, what is the reality that they're actually going to monitor this stuff underground and make sure it stays there? I mean, it's despite in beyond all the cost issues, the regulatory issues, the liability issues, if this stuff leaks out, someone is asphyxiated in their basement, who's liable for it? I mean, there's a lot of problems here that we haven't even begun to touch.
Wow.
And so at a certain point, you begin to think, well, maybe there is a better way. Maybe we should be thinking a lot harder about alternatives to coal than perpetuating this old machine.
Jeff Goodell, you're brilliant, and we're glad you're on it. The book is Big Coal. Thank you very much for joining us today, Jeff.
Thanks for having me.
Howard Herzog, where are you putting your hopes, dear scientist? I mean, we want what you're working on to work. The federal government backing away here. What's your hope, your prayer? Where's your effort go now?
Well, at times I get pessimistic, not so much on this specific technology, because I want to make it clear. I think the important thing is to keep your options open. And if it turns out that we don't need this technology, that we have other alternatives, I think a lot of people would be happy. But one reason I really work hard on this is I don't see those alternatives out there, at least not in the, coming decades.
So we may need this to bar the door.
That's right. And, you know, if you start looking at the big problem, you sometimes get very pessimistic. So sometimes you have to say, okay, we know there's issues. We have to put one step ahead of us. And this is a very difficult problem, as was pointed out. And therefore, I say, since it's a difficult problem, we got to get started sooner rather than later. And that's why the starts and stops in terms of the federal government policy here, their underfunding of research, and not only this, but all climate change things, is very disheartening.
Ladies and gentlemen, watch this space and hope something fills it. Howard Herzog, Principal Research Engineer at MIT's Laboratory for Energy and the Environment. Professor Herzog, it's been great having you. Thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.